This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we'll look at the latest developments and atrocities in Afghanistan. We'll be speaking with United States Marine Corps veteran Rick Reyes, as well as Robert Naiman of Just Foreign Policy. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the world is watching for the latest reaction from Afghanistan in the wake of the most recent atrocity in which a staff sergeant slaughtered 16 people. Some Afghans have vowed vengeance after the murder of the 16, including 9 children, in a weekend killing spree that President Hamid Karzai said cannot be forgiven. Officials are bracing for revenge attacks from insurgents and civilians as well. The suspect, a staff sergeant who was identified unofficially as being from Joint Base Lewis McChord's 3rd Striker Brigade, was assigned to what is euphemistically called village stability programs inside Afghanistan. The Taliban had begun to show signs of progress in talks with the United States in anticipation of a proclaimed withdrawal sometime in 2014. However, tactical indications are that NATO and American and other troops do have plans for a stay in Afghanistan well beyond that. One might recall that it was President Bush who sent 30-some thousand troops to Afghanistan, but President Obama, who in subsequent days sent more than twice as many more troops to Afghanistan and promised to have them in the path of withdrawal by now, but that has yet to come to credible passage. One of the testifiers on the conduct of the U.S. war and occupation of Afghanistan is a United States Marine Corps veteran named Rick Reyes, who testified before Congress, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on the 23rd of April, 2009. And as a veteran, he had some insights about the real state of the war in Afghanistan. Here now, Corporal Rick Reyes.
First off, I want to thank Senator Kerry for giving me the inspiration of being here today. I sit here 38 years after you were expressing your opinions on the Vietnam War, and similarly want to express my opinions about this occupation. I also want to thank the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for having me here. I also want to say that I love my country, and that is why I'm here today. My name is Rick Reyes, and a veteran of both Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. I served with the United States Marine Corps as an infantry rifleman. We took an oath to defend this country, and that doesn't stop when we check in our rifles into the armory. We keep our country safe by telling people the truth, and doing that is just as scary as any ambush or mortar attack. I come from very humble beginnings and a son to both an immigrant father and mother from Mexico. I grew up in East Los Angeles in one of the roughest parts of town known as Boyle Heights. Later, my family moved to Southeast Los Angeles to escape the violence, but that wasn't far enough. As a kid, I always envisioned myself of one day fighting for my country and ensuring justice. Like most of my peers, when I was younger, I got involved with the wrong crowd. After escaping a serious tragedy in my life, I knew the Marine Corps could provide me the opportunity to not only serve my country, but to also straighten out my life by doing something honorable. On the night of the September 11 attacks, my battalion sat in port in Australia. It was sometime around midnight, and we were enjoying our off time at the local bars, when all of a sudden the music stopped, and over the PR system an announcement heard that the U.S. was being under attack. We were all ordered to head back and aboard the ships. That night, we were told we were going to war with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. The next morning, we pulled out of port, and for the next month, while the administration formulated a plan, we prepared to go to war with the conviction of fighting for justice and the American way. Our mission was to locate and capture suspected members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. Through my experience as an infantry rifleman, implemented past and current policy have found it almost impossible to locate and capture the Taliban, because there isn't any effective way to separate them from the innocent civilian population. Patrols were conducted through populated neighborhoods. The populations on those neighborhood streets weren't any different from the population on my street. There were kids running around and playing while we occupied their streets. Mothers running behind after those kids, making sure they stay out of trouble and out of our way, and fathers trying to make a living for the little that they have. U.S. hired translators would tell us where suspected Taliban or Al-Qaeda would be found. We would follow their lead, often planning attacks and breaking into people's homes. Due to our training in fighting wars and killing enemy, we wouldn't enter these homes or situations quietly, but instead trained to fight with the vigilance of encountering death at every turn. Although we were on the hunt for suspected Taliban forces, at the end of it, we found that these dangerous missions resulted with very poor consequences by destroying innocent lives. We weren't fulfilling our objective of capturing terrorists, but instead creating enemies out of civilians. As a Marine trying to ensure justice, I began losing sight of why I was there, and the conviction began to fade. Because our mission was to capture suspected Taliban and had no successful way of being able to distinguish them, we had no other choice but to suspect the entire civilian population, innocent or not. One day we stopped at gunpoint, detained, beating, and nearly killing an innocent man, only to find out he was just traveling down the road to deliver milk to his children. Because of that, that day those kids went without a father. There were hundreds of incidents like this one. Almost 100% of the time, we would find that suspected terrorists turned out to be innocent civilians. We began to feel we were chasing ghosts, fighting an enemy that we could not see or that didn't allow itself to be seen. How can you tell the difference between the Taliban and Afghan civilians? The answer is that you can't. It all stopped making sense. Later, I found out that these translators were being compensated on the amount of intelligence they were able to provide. So it was their incentive to be able to provide as much intelligence as possible without any way to know if the information being provided was false. It was such a flawed system, but who was I to question authority? When I returned home, I felt that occupying Afghanistan and Iraq was a mistake. I strongly feel that the military occupation and intervention is not the answer. If it didn't work back in 2001, when we had all the energy, all our resources, but most important, a very high troop morale, I asked myself, how could it work now? A lot of these men and women serving our country in the armed forces have been desperately worn and stretched out too thin by having them serve in up to 4 tours overseas. If we aren't killing them on the ground due to a flawed policy, we are definitely killing them in spirit. And that also has a very serious indirect consequence when the fight is brought back home. I love my country, and never once while serving did I feel I was protecting America. But instead, we were harboring the worst of sentiments in these foreign Middle Eastern countries. We were creating more enemies. As a kid, I envisioned myself serving my country and fighting for freedom. But when the opportunity presented itself, it was stripped from me. And instead, I was forced to become a tyrant. As I have experienced, our troops are also experiencing a very low morale, which oftentimes translates into high suicide rates. These are just a few of the issues. There is just a huge array of reasons why, at the minimum, this occupation needs to be rethought. We should not be sending any more troops into Afghanistan. As a combat troop, we are trained to isolate and destroy the enemy, cut off its resources. As an indirect consequence, we impose our Western views and alienate their culture and traditions. In some respects, this entire occupation has become counterproductive. As a Marine, I was willing to give my life for my country and still am, but invading and occupying Afghanistan, sending more troops to solve what is a political problem is not the answer. I urge these senators to rethink Afghanistan while there is still time. I can almost guarantee that sending more troops will mean more civilian and U.S. troop casualties, not for war, but for occupation. Sending more troops will not make the U.S. safer. It will only build more opposition against us. I urge you on behalf of truth and patriotism to consider carefully and rethink Afghanistan. More troops, more occupation is not the answer. Thank you.
And that was Marine Corporal Rick Reyes testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in April 2009. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined live by Marine Corporal Rick Reyes. And Rick, first of all, let us thank you for your service to the nation and Semper Fi. And secondly, even more, for your courage regarding the state of the nation as exemplified in your testimony to Congress, and the idea of whether it is sustainable to have infinite wars and occupations. What is your position on Afghanistan today, sir?
Well, my position hasn't changed since 2009. I still believe that we are facing a failed policy. A lot of the reasons that I outlined before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee still exist. For example, just the line between enemy combatants and civilians is very thin, and at times it's blurred. There's just no real efficient way to distinguish the two.
When you, as a Marine, or whether it be soldiers or sailors or anyone else involved in foreign occupations in alien cultures, do you think that you knew enough when you went there, or that troops or Marines or soldiers are sufficiently trained? And in fact, is the military mission incompatible with the preservation of civilians?
Yeah, I definitely believe that there is no military solution in Afghanistan. What we're dealing with is a social economic and political problem. We are competing with the Taliban, and the Taliban has presented the case that they'll provide the necessary resources, they'll provide economic support, and for us, while we try to achieve the same goals, we're contracting a lot of that support out to foreigners. So we're not investing in the lawyers and engineers and doctors of tomorrow in Afghanistan. We're actually diverting a lot of these resources to foreign contractors, and once the resources run out, they leave, and we're not allowing Afghans to take ownership of their own capacity.
You mentioned foreign contractors, and it is our understanding that in places like Afghanistan and certainly in Iraq, the number of privateers actually exceeds the number of troops there, particularly by a factor of, if I'm correct, 2 to 1, 200,000 to 100,000 or so in Iraq. And when you were in service, did you see any difference between the operation of the military and the prevalence or even superiority of private contractors?
Well, there's a lot of obvious differences. The security element is very similar to what we're there to do. But then other elements like the reconstruction effort and the building of infrastructure, that's very different. But nonetheless, I think figures or reports that I've seen is that for every dollar spent in Afghanistan to a contractor, 75 cents actually leave the country, so it doesn't have a direct impact. And I traveled back to Afghanistan in 2009, and you could just the plague and the suffering. It's very obvious. There isn't any real social support. These schools are completely deteriorated. The plumbing is almost non-existent. Industry doesn't exist at all, so it's just a very unfortunate situation, and our continued presence doesn't counter the need for economic support.
It would be negligent if I did not ask you what your impression is, having been on the battlefield, having been on the scene, to the latest atrocity in Afghanistan, where a staff sergeant, an army staff sergeant, is accused of going out on a slaughter spree and killing 16 people, including 9 children. What is your perception about this kind of incident?
You know, it's very tragic. It's very tragic indeed, and I'm torn over the incident, frustrated and angered. Because these are the kinds of incidents that we kept warning against, and it's just it just exemplifies the dysfunctional relationship between the U.S. coalition forces and the Afghan population. As one officer in Afghanistan put it, they hate us and we don't trust them. And the longer we stay, the more resentment and resistance that we provoke.
In your service in the region during the occupation, is there anything that insufficiently educates you as a stranger in a strange land and the natural customs of the local people? Were you sufficiently educated, and did you ever see any signs of intolerance or bias in regard to the local population?
It's always a mixed experience. Obviously, there are those who really hate the fact that we're there, and there are those who support us, and primarily the ones who support our presence are the ones that are actually benefiting from that presence itself. Whether that be with supplies or food or whatnot, they themselves have mixed feelings. They recognize there's a serious problem to our presence, but then they also recognize that they are in need of social support. So even among those that seem supportive, they're still very torn within themselves whether we should remain in the country or not. And then there are those who just really don't want us there. And we experience that on a day-to-day basis by having rocks thrown at you. You know, even children, you see them just giving very negative expression as they see U.S. troops coming by.
Corporal Reyes, I know that as a Marine, your commitment was commendably to follow the orders of the Commander-in-Chief and so on. But I'd like to just get outside of that for a moment and ask you, philosophically and legally and morally, whether you agree that military action is a proper or legal substitute for criminal prosecution for acts of murder or acts of conspiracy. Are you concerned about the use of the military to pursue legal grievances around the world today?
Absolutely not. If we're there to support Afghans, you can't bring that support at the end of a barrel. You can't bring peace at the end of a barrel. We really have to emphasize on intelligence and good police work to go capture those responsible, and we've managed to do that with a very small footprint of troops, very, very small strike forces that have gone into Pakistan to find Bin Laden, and as a result, he was in Afghanistan. And this could have been done very differently without the need for such a large footprint and investing resources into a country that we shouldn't be in, that we have no business being in.
One other policy question here. Do you believe that the administration or even the contending presidential candidates actually intend to end the war and occupation in Afghanistan? Do you believe it is possible within the near term to end that war, and if so, how?
I applaud the president for ending the war in Iraq, and I also applaud him for committing to a timeline withdrawal and for the drawdown of troops. But what we're finding out is that the timeline of 2014 isn't soon enough, and now there's been reports coming out of the administration that the drawdown or the combat role of the troops will end by mid-2013, but even then, that might not.
From what I'm hearing, Ricky, is that the infrastructure and the so-called turnover, sort of like the status of forces agreement in Iraq, will extend many years beyond that. NATO and other allies are saying that they're maintaining a superstructure inside the country for well beyond 2014.
Well, we heard in the past about the counterinsurgency policy. For one, it's a failed policy. It's destined to fail. It just won't work because what you need is a strong internal ally. And the only ally that we have in Afghanistan that's organic to the region is the Karzai government. And unfortunately, the Afghan population doesn't trust the government. So it's not the kind of ally that we need. So if we're there supporting a structure that Afghans don't trust to begin with, then that doesn't allow us to be very credible. So that whole policy won't work for those reasons. And not only that, you need, I think, a footprint of 500,000 troops, whether that be American troops or Afghan forces, for well over 15 to 20 years, if that's the policy that's being pursued, which is just not realistic. And I think we're starting to see that. We just have to keep the pressure on and try to really reflect on the incidents that are occurring now, like the burning of the Quran and this incident over the weekend, and really put things into perspective and ask ourselves if it's worth staying in through 2013 or 2014. And the official reports are that by 2013, we're going to end our combat role. We're going to be withdrawing our combat troops and just have a supportive role to train the Afghan forces. But another thing that we're not taking into account is that the Afghan army, you know, it, a large portion of that population is illiterate. They can't write, they can't read, and there's high desertion rates. Right? So I think it's like 20-30% of Afghan forces desert their duty. And we hear these instances of Afghan forces turning on U.S. troops and other coalition forces. So the goals that we're trying to achieve aren't realistic. They're not achievable. So we have to withdraw much sooner than later and turn invest resources in the Afghans themselves so they can take ownership of their own reconstruction effort.
How can people keep up to date with what you are doing to advance the cause of international justice these days?
I'm very involved with Rethink Afghanistan, so you can visit our website at rethinkafghanistan.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Rick_Reyes, and always looking for feedback and just trying to build partnerships with other organizations who are for the drawdown of the Afghanistan war.
Well, I thank you for your tactical and moral courage, and please send my best regards to our mutual friend, Norman Solomon.
I definitely will.
Thank you, Corporal Rick Reyes, late of the United States Marine Corps, who also has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we're now joined by Robert Naiman of JustForeignPolicy.org. We've been speaking with a participant in the Afghanistan deployment. And Robert, welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow. Let me just begin with, what is your understanding of the current situation in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, that the United, at least for many Afghans, the U.S. has stayed long past its welcome. And that set of Afghans appears to be increasing month by month. Just in the past 3 months, we've had these three spectacular incidents. The massacre on Sunday last month, the spectacular incident was the Quran burnings and the violent protests and reprisals that followed, not just the protests, but the Afghan soldiers attacking U.S. soldiers. The previous month, it was the video of the Marines urinating on the insurgent corpses. So, the each one of these incidents happens, and of course, officials say, well, this is a terrible tragedy, but it's an isolated instance. It doesn't prove anything. But, you have isolated incidents after isolated incidents, then the instances aren't isolated anymore. And we have now a pattern. And part of what's going on is that the U.S. Army appears to be breaking a little bit, or significantly. The suspect in the Sunday shootings, this was his fourth deployment. He'd been deployed three times to Iraq. Apparently, he had a traumatic head injury from his time in Iraq. That's not enough to tell the causation story, but it's enough to ask questions about correlation and, suggest that the reason to expect further incidents like this in the future. And the plans of the Obama administration, the U.S. government, everybody knows that there's the drawdown. So that's good. There's going to be fewer U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That should mean fewer incidents like this.
Well,
but the plans are also for more intense, the people who remain to be more intensely connected to Afghan forces, and that's a problem if trust between U.S. and Afghan forces is totally breaking down, which that appears to be taking place.
Well, Robert, let me be the skeptic here. I do not for a minute believe there'll be a withdrawal of United States forces by the end of 2014. I, later in the program, will present a statement by President Obama in 2009 saying they'd be on their way out by 2011. There are indications that, just as with the Status of Forces Agreement in Iraq, that the United States and NATO allies are planning a continuing infrastructure inside Afghanistan that will last well beyond the second half of this decade. Do you really believe that there will be a withdrawal, or simply, like Iraq, a declaration that those who remain are not, quote, combat troops, quote?
Well, that's a good and pregnant question. A couple things. First of all, you're absolutely right to say, and I never said differently, that I spoke about the, you know, U.S. forces are being drawn down. There's a distinction between a drawdown and a complete withdrawal. In other words, there are fewer U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan than there were at the height of the surge. But that doesn't mean that the planned endpoint is zero. So those are two different things. So you're exactly right, I think, to call attention to, you know, the question of what does 2014 mean? And in fact, it's a deliberately fuzzy boundary. You'll see in the press, you know, New York Times complained to the New York Times about this, about the reporting on this, saying that, you know, there is a deadline or a timetable for all foreign forces or all U.S. forces to withdraw from Afghanistan. There is not. There is this goal for transition to Afghan lead, and there's a drawdown, meaning fewer U.S. forces, but not zero in 2014. And in fact, the U.S. has been negotiating an agreement with a long-term security partnership with Afghanistan, which envisages a role for tens of thousands of U.S. troops after 2014. Now, you make the analogy to Iraq, and I think that it's good to understand, you know, why that's a good analogy to think about. In the fact, and the situation is actually different from Iraq in an important way. In the case of Iraq, after 2008, there was a signed agreement between the U.S. government and the Iraqi government that stated quite explicitly that after December 31st, 2011, there will be no U.S. troops or Department of Defense contractors in Iraq. And it was widely believed that something different from that was going to happen, and there was effort by the Obama administration to negotiate something different, but that effort collapsed. And it is essentially true now that almost all, you know, there's the Marines in the embassy, but the U.S. uniformed soldiers and Department of Defense contractors have been withdrawn from Iraq. That doesn't mean every American with a gun, because their game was to switch things over to the State Department with private contractors to protect their huge embassy and so on and so forth. So that's something worth scrutinizing, absolutely. But this doesn't mean the agreement wasn't real. And the reason that's important is because in the case of Afghanistan, we have no such agreement. There's no agreement between the United States and Afghanistan that has a deadline for the withdrawal of all U.S. forces. And if there were such an agreement, that would be an advance. And we should be demanding such an agreement and not this fuzzy deadline that exists today. And I also think it's important to distinguish between what people in the Pentagon want and what will happen if other people speak up and demand something different. So the Pentagon didn't want to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq in December 2011, but they lost. They lost the fight with the Iraqi people and the Iraqi parliament, and they also lost the fight inside the administration. And they could lose in the case of Afghanistan. Right now, the official position of the Obama administration is try to negotiate this long-term presence. But there is a fight inside the administration. There's growing opposition in Congress. Even some of the Republican presidential candidates, not just Ron Paul, are starting, you know, Mr. Gingrich, Mr. Santorum, are starting to ask questions about, you know, what we're doing there. So I wouldn't say that God hasn't decreed that there will be U.S. troops in Afghanistan after 2014. It's still very much in an important arena of struggle.
We're speaking with Robert Naiman of JustForeignPolicy.org, one of the excellent progressive think tanks about international military affairs and related matters. And Robert, this brings to me what some people might find a confusing quandary. And that is, I remember the history of the Vietnam War, in which Democratic Party presidents escalated and it took a Republican to end it. I'm speaking about JFK and LBJ, Kennedy and Johnson, with the buildup during the 1960s and the ongoing war that it took a change of administrations to finally bring to an end. And oddly enough, today's circumstance tempts a replication of that. Barack Obama is gung-ho. That was one of his campaign platforms about, I want to fight the good war in Afghanistan. And now you've got this crew of would-be Republican presidential candidates now backing away and saying they want to end the Afghanistan war. What is going on, and how do we get past the mono-party bipartisan confusion of domestic politics in regard to war policy?
Well, opportunism in these political opportunities in these issues is nothing new. Nixon escalated the Vietnam War, too. He said he had a secret plan to end the war, and then when he got in, he escalated before, you know, finally, as a result of, you know, massive public opposition changing course. And it, we should also note that the Mr. Romney has not added his voice, who's, you know, widely considered to be the likely Republican nominee, has not added his voice to this new criticism. So, on the contrary, you know, he has been, he said, we have to listen to generals. So, in other words, we can't withdraw forces. He's criticized the Obama administration for the drawdown that's now underway. I would also say I wouldn't describe at this point the Obama administration as gung-ho. You're absolutely right about what they said in the campaign in 2008 about the good war. And, of course, he got in and he escalated repeatedly in terms of adding troops and adding mission to the war in Afghanistan. Now they are on a different course, a course whose outcome is still yet to be determined. It's a fuzzy course. They are drawing down U.S. forces. They are scaling back the U.S. mission, but they have not made clear what their endpoint is. But I think that is, again, I think this is a jump ball. You know, it was already the case a year ago that every Democrat in the House of Representatives, except for six, voted for a resolution saying that the president should establish a firm timetable for the withdrawal of all U.S. forces. That was a year ago. And public opinion among all Americans, and particularly among Democrats and independents, has soured on the war even more since then. You have people, you know, inside the administration who are saying that the current policy makes no sense and we should get out. So I think this is very much a jump ball, and particularly because, you know, in addition to the voices of those who are against the current policy because it's totally immoral and is leading to unnecessary and cruel loss of life, both Afghans and Americans, I think you can add now to those voices, you know, more, perhaps more opportunistic political actors. You know, there was just a poll published by ABC Washington Post. 60% of Americans say that the war in Afghanistan is not worth it, hasn't been worth it. 54% say the U.S. should get out before completing whatever training mission they're working on. Only 30% believe that the Afghan public supports the presence of U.S. troops. So the policy is vulnerable. And with these incidents, these catastrophic incidents happening every month, the status quo is actually a political liability for the Obama administration. You know, the conventional wisdom is that the administration and election year can't afford to do anything risky, like seriously pursuing peace talks with the Afghan Taliban or accelerating the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But the status quo is risky. Look how the status quo is leading to these catastrophes month by month. So I think there's an opportunity for a rethink here among Democrats and among, you know, Democrats who tend to support the Obama administration, an opportunity for them to pressure the Obama administration to change course now, simply tread water till October.
It's always a revelation to have you with us on 5 O'Clock Shadow, and I thank you for that, Robert Naiman. How can people follow your work and tell us in the remaining minute or so about the work of Just Foreign Policy?
Our website is www.justforeignpolicy.org. We send out news about U.S. foreign policy, alerts with opportunities for action. I also write on U.S. foreign policy at Huffington Post, Truth Out, Common Dreams, and Al Jazeera. And people can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. My handle on Twitter is at Naiman, my last name, N-A-I-M-A-N.
Well, thank you. I suspect we'll be speaking more sooner as events develop in Afghanistan and elsewhere around the world. Thank you so much for joining us today, Robert Naiman, on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Good to speak with you.
Always. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight. And as Robert pointed out, the latest poll on the United States public perception about the war in Afghanistan is that nearly two-thirds, or more than 60% of Americans, believe the war is, quote, not worth fighting, quote, as the question was posed. But interestingly, those who strongly believe in the war have now been reduced to 17% of those polled by ABC. And one other item, this just in from President Barack Obama. He says that he takes the situation in Afghanistan seriously. And he is quoted as saying, quote, "The United States takes this as seriously as if it were our own citizens and our own children who were murdered," end quote, President Barack Obama on the latest atrocity inside Afghanistan, where he doubled the number of troops sent in by President George W. Bush. We now continue with the statement of a nascent President Barack Obama on December 1st, 2009, in which he promised that by last year, the troops in Afghanistan would have begun their withdrawal.
I want to speak to you tonight about our effort in Afghanistan, the nature of our commitment there, the scope of our interests, and the strategy that my administration will pursue to bring this war to a successful conclusion. And as Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we will pursue the following objectives within Afghanistan. We must deny Al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will meet these objectives in three ways. First, we will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers. They'll increase our ability to train competent Afghan security forces and to partner with them so that more Afghans can get into the fight. And they will help create the conditions for the United States to transfer responsibility to the Afghans. I've asked that our commitment be joined by contributions from our allies. Some have already provided additional troops, and we're confident that there will be further contributions in the days and weeks ahead. Now, taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Second, we will work with our partners, the United Nations, and the Afghan people to pursue a more effective civilian strategy. This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. And we will also focus our assistance in areas such as agriculture that can make an immediate impact in the lives of the Afghan people. Third, we will act with the full recognition that our success in Afghanistan is inextricably linked to our partnership with Pakistan. We will strengthen Pakistan's capacity to target those groups that threaten our countries and have made it clear that we cannot tolerate a safe haven for terrorists whose location is known and whose intentions are clear. America is also providing substantial resources to support Pakistan's democracy and development. These are the three core elements of our strategy: a military effort to create the conditions for a transition, a civilian surge that reinforces positive action, and an effective partnership with Pakistan. It's easy to forget that when this war began, we were united, bound together by the fresh memory of a horrific attack, and by the determination to defend our homeland and the values we hold dear. I refuse to accept the notion that we cannot summon that unity again.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man'll be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. All at once, the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Barroso. We welcome your comments, tips, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow, T-H-E-S-H-A-D-O-W, at WBAI.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.